This week in the Inkstuds will be featuring an interview with Gary Penter. This is part one of three parts. The interview, the other two parts, will be available online at inkstuds.com. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM out of Vancouver. This is the Inkstuds radio show. Gary Penter is one of my favorite cartoonists, but calling him a cartoonist is pretty much an understatement. He has a wonderful book coming out from Picturebox Books at the end of the month, featuring a whole range of collection of different work that he's done over the last, I would say, 25 to 30 years. It's really quite voluminous, quite extensive, and quite incredible. You should check it out. Here we go, Gary Penter.
Returns Every Morning, Chapter 1.
How are you doing this evening?
Pretty good.
So you're working in on your, I guess, upcoming opening in Connecticut?
Yeah, I'm working on all kinds of stuff. I'm actually kind of stunned today. I'm not teaching. I taught Monday and Tuesday, and then today I was waiting for art movers. So I'm kind of sitting here, kind of sleeping, wondering what I should be working on.
So I've caught you in a momentary lull?
Yeah.
No. So, the show, it's interviews with comic creators, but I kind of step out of the box of standard comic stuff and have interviewed Ralph Steadman before.
Well, and, a cartoonist.
Kind of. I mean, it's pretty influential in a lot of people.
Yeah.
And like Genesis Peoridge, who's not even comics at all, but it's my show and I can do what I want.
He's a cartoon character.
I guess in a way he is.
He's really taken control of his image.
Mm-hmm. You're up to date with his transgendered.
Yeah, and didn't his wife die recently or something?
Mm-hmm. She
that's terrible.
Yeah, quite a young age too. From what I understand, it was a heart attack just probably about 6 months ago, and I'm sure she was under 40.
Yeah.
So undiagnosed.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's a partner, not wife.
Yeah, but I think they were trying to become each other in a way surgically. It seemed like that was the kind of idea, was them to match each other or something.
Mm-hmm. They both got, like, he got the breast augmentation, and they both had plastic surgery on their faces to kind of meld into one being.
Yeah, so that's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I do read about him.
What a way to start out. We'll start out by people passing away. So just, you know, I've actually read your book, the new one from Picturebox.
Uh-huh.
Dan got me a copy of the PDF.
Uh-huh.
So I had a chance to peruse the massive tome that it is. It's quite the impressive venture.
Yeah, I can't compute it, you know. I know it's an exciting thing and a good thing, but I can't take it in, really.
I think it's going to be, what, 700 pages, about that?
It's almost 700 pages and divided in two volumes, yeah.
The second volume being just primarily sketchbook, and the first volume being, I guess, a career-wide look at your different...
That's right. And, the second one's just mostly sketchbook, like spreads from sketchbooks. Yeah, the first book kind of ignores illustration to a great extent, which I kind of wanted to do, and just I think that people, and I think that was our idea with the book in some ways, was I've been like painting all these years, but I'm totally known as an illustrator and a cartoonist.
Well, that's the fascinating thing going through the book is looking at the, first I went through the first book, and then I went through the second book, it's just seeing the process in there too. From starting out with the illustration and then working into the paintings, and the paintings themselves being like a whole series of story in itself.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole set of associations there. It's kind of like an untranslatable hieroglyph or something, but it's really, it's crazy. I think the book is, it's like when people come into my room, at first I think they get excited and then they get confused after a while. And I think the book might be a little bit like that too.
Kind of a sensory overload.
Yeah, that you come in and like the paintings, even though they're really crazy, I think they're a real soothing part of the book in a way. And then when you hit the back, it's just like, oh my God, it's like a bunch of closets opened.
You're meaning the sketchbook part?
Or no, just in the back other? Of the painting book.
Okay.
In the back of the painting book, it has light shows, puppets, mm-hmm. model houses, comics, and peewee, and all kinds of junk.
Well, like I said, the many pies your fingers are in.
Yeah.
Now, it seems throughout them, there is a uniform kind of idea behind the look, behind all your work. Is that kind of a way to go about it?
Well, there's kind of not one style exactly. I think there might be a way that I naturally put things together, and there's certainly like all the things I've copied or observed, and you know, people I'm a fan of.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I kind of mean. It's like that. Yeah. Like you look at someone like Burroughs, who does writing and artwork and stuff, but there is kind of a universal theme throughout it.
You can tell it's Burroughs back mm-hmm. there somehow.
Exactly.
I guess his theme would be transparent newt boys, you know, with phosphorescent sex organs. You know, that would be the theme, probably.
El hombre invisible.
Yeah, right.
So, your first artistic vocation, I guess, your interest was painting?
Well, yeah. Drawing, I mean, naturally... drawing's the easiest thing to do, but then by the time I was 12, I was real excited about painting and really studying modern art and stuff, and so then by the time I was in high school, I had turned the garage into my hippie art pad, you know, and was painting big paintings, and I went off to art school, and it was great, and I had a lot of fun, and I just kept painting, you know, so it's just a something that excites me. I'm surprised, like I probably said somewhere else, that more cartoonists don't paint. A lot of them do, I think. But I was surprised Kaz and Mark Newgarden in particular weren't painters when I first met them.
Has Mark Newgarden ever done any painting?
He probably has, but I don't think it's interesting to him.
Yeah.
So far.
It doesn't strike me as something with his kind of style of the kind of deconstructed comic that it would be something that he would venture into.
Well, it's funny, when he was first starting out, it was kind of like when Richard Prince was first starting out, you know, and that work of Richard Prince's where he just takes gag cartoons and blows them up and silk screens them on some material. I mean, Mark could have done that a little bit before him, but I don't know.
It's more of that raw interest in the comics.
Yeah, and Mark's a really, you know, a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Like Matt Groening's a writer as well as a cartoonist, and, so we have to go that way.
Now, recently on your website, you featured your father's painting. So he was a big influence on you growing up?
Yeah. We lived in a house trailer in the early 1950s, and it was full of his oil paintings. And then when we went to Brownsville, he kept painting. He gradually kind of like slowed up just because he had to make money to raise three kids. And then when he started getting close to retirement, then he's painted like a lot since he retired. He's still painting.
It's quite interesting. It's like he's... I'm trying to think the best way to describe it. It's like a kind of... The style seems like a futuristic look at First Nations culture.
At what culture?
At his own First Nations culture.
Uh-huh.
Just that, I guess there's like a shine to it that I'm kind of seeing.
Yeah, it was always stylized, but there were a lot of Native American artists in the 50s or 40s. There must have been like a program, a WPA or Department of Interior program or Indian school thing, where they put silk screen in the hands of Indians. And so there were all these people, I don't know their names, Woody Crumbo is one who did really colorful outline stylistic things. And I kind of think that's where my father's coming from, but he doesn't seem to remember it.
How did that component stick with you? Because throughout your work, that is definitely a part.
Well, I think there's a weirdly, you know, he's right-handed and really has more control over what he does in some ways. And but there's always some weird similarity because he doesn't really look at my work, you know. I mean, he'll see it when this book comes out, but there's always kind of a similarity in what we're doing somehow, and just we have these blended kind of things, and it's imagery and it's outlined often. And now my daughter's an art, you know, becoming an artist, you know, in the last few years and going to art school, you know, so it's kind of neat, just, you know, kind of have permission from your family, you know, without any pressure to do something.
You don't feel bad for going to art school in your family?
No, I loved art school. It was fantastic, and I hope it'll be fun for her. My father minored in art in college.
Now, for you, starting comics was, what was the interest in starting working on comics when you were going to school for the painting?
Well, I'd drawn comics when I was a little kid, a little bit, with friends especially, but it was really Zap Comics, I think. It was just seeing Zap Comics in... And I didn't even see Zap Comics for a while. I just saw a little picture of the cover of it in I Magazine. And just from that tiny little picture, it totally reminded me of the Nutt Brothers and Major Hoople and all these kind of Popeye, that kind of rounds Bigfoot style, I guess, that Crumb was doing. And it just like, it kind of showed that you could go forward by going backward in a way. I mean, just that one little picture. Just like... Say like Jasper Johns influenced a whole bunch of painters at like about 1959 or 60 just by a couple of pieces he did all over the world, and I think Crumb was the same way. And then luckily there was this whole crowd of people that were like super talented that happened to end up in San Francisco up there and work on Zap. You know, and then when everybody else joined up, then like worse drawers joined up, but at the first it was excellent drawers.
The watering down of the pool.
Yeah, but, you know, some of that bad stuff is quite good in its own way. You know, I'm a fan of George Hanson, and he's still, I guess he's painting and in bands in Chicago now, I guess.
Yeah, I think not a lot of the underground guys still do the comics.
Well, it's expensive to do it unless it accidentally makes money for you, you know. It takes a lot of time, and I guess Crumb, you know, has a big enough audience that it makes him money.
Yeah. Well, he's Robert Crumb. Now, for yourself, you're saying comics can take quite a lot of time. Do you find them to be a lot more laborious than when you're working on a painting? Because you... Like the difference between the two?
Yeah, I think comics are a lot harder in a way. Painting, I can be real temperamental about it, and I have to wait for my energy and be sensitive and all that kind of junk. But I have a a methodology when I paint, and it starts in drawings that become cartoons in the traditional sense for the paintings, and then I'm scaling them up somehow, you know, with a simple invisible grid, and so I just kind of know the steps, and then I'm kind of going through it, and it's like, and it's about color. Wow, there's a nice color. What would look nice with that color, or all that kind of junk, you know, but comics, either you're trying to tell a story or you're trying to obscure it and fool around with the form or doing something formal or whatever, and each box is like a painting or an illustration,
mm-hmm.
and you have problems of how much information you can cram into the balloons and steadiness and all kinds of stuff.
Now, it seems with your paintings, you're kind of trying to explore things a little further.
Well, they're more associative. I would say like my comic strip Del Tokyo became very associative for a number of years. When the book comes out, it's just like kind of like a surreal cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of playing around with the form of cartoons, whereas in painting, I'm fooling around with the form of painting, but it's kind of very traditional just in terms of modern art, because a lot of the paintings I like were either... I like all kinds of art and paintings, but... turn of the century stuff of the last century, all those experiments are interesting, and then English pop art's particularly interesting, and then the Chicago Imagery School and all of those kind of things, Peter Saul and that stuff is really, it just suggests a whole world of exploration there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Picasso was a big influence on you.
Definitely. And he's really, you see all these people in art history, like with Picasso standing in their path and they're trying to figure out how to get around him. You know? Like Jackson Pollock. He turns back into Picasso at the end of his career. You know? And a lot of people, because Picasso is a really super strong drawer, and he's doing these formal experiments, and so at the time it's happening, it's like he's claiming all this territory in some sense. But then you have people like Paul Klee come along, and he's like, he didn't seem to be bothered by Picasso very much, and did a lot of the same. Well, also Picasso is always also borrowing from all the people that are around him too.
Mm-hmm.
So
I guess a big thing with Picasso is important to understand is he didn't just end up being a cubist. It's that whole progression and getting to that point.
Yeah, and then past it, and then the weird, you know, kind of hidden stuff, and the sculptures, and I mean, he did a lot of things. He did so much work, you know. It's kind of like there had to be a lot of bad work if you do that much work. By doing that much work, then you let the good stuff out, you know, whereas you can sit and stare at a wall and try to think of the perfect painting and actually make that painting, maybe, but it's kind of more fun to, like, let things flow, and then, you know, if, and you could be critical and throw things away, you know, that work good.
Do you set a certain schedule for yourself for when you're working on art?
I kind of have a natural rhythm, and part of it was set up by my daughter being in public school, and
mm-hmm.
So I had to get up, drive her to school, read the newspaper, drink chocolate milk, go back to bed for an hour, get up, do errands all day and stuff, and then try to stay up as late as I can at night to work when it's quiet.
Mm-hmm. Most people tend to do their best at night, I guess.
Well, the phone stops ringing, and every, you know, the chores can't be done. You know, I can't drive anywhere and do a chore in the middle of the night. You know, I'm not going to.
But New York is a 24-hour city.
Yeah, right. Yep.
I've only been
dark
there,
out there.
I've only been there once, but it was a loud, loud experience.
If you're in Manhattan, it just seems like someone's beating a trash can by your head the whole time. You know?
That was pretty much it. I stayed down just outside the meatpacking district.
Yep.
And it was just like, yeah.
We're packing. Yeah, Brooklyn's a little quieter, but someone, you know, is. This is a weird neighborhood because it's big houses and yards and stuff. But someone's always working on their car out front.
So you're pretty removed from the central busyness of the New York madness.
Well, it's still the city, but there's not necessarily someone beating on a garbage can. They might be, like, emptying a magazine two blocks away on Flatbush in the middle of the night. I hear that quite often. Someone just emptying firing the whole thing off. I guess they're just shooting at the moon.
Gotta take it down. Maybe they're scared because of the eclipse the other day.
Yeah, right.
That was just last week.
Kill the moon.
Now, I guess I'm gonna go into a little bit more into the some of the painting stuff. I'm wondering about one thing that really struck me is you did a series of I guess turn of the century, like 1800s, 1900s figures in Western culture, in like the buffalo stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
What was like? I don't know. It's just the descriptions behind the paintings are quite interesting, and I just don't know like the what are the images that you're trying to link to that.
There wasn't necessarily a correlation, really. It was just putting overlaying two different activities in one activity, and then observing to see if there were correlations, and a couple of times there were, and so that was fun. But one activity was reading a lot about Native American history, and then also really seeing that the crisis with the bison, or whatever you want to call it, in the 1880s. It was just so extreme. It was just so crazy to go from somewhere between 20 and 40 million bison down to 6,000 on the continent is like so crazy and obscene, you know. And being part Native American, I wanted to read about that because I hadn't, like, it's kind of you can tell it's going to be depressing, you know. And so when I went into it, it was extremely depressing. But I was looking at, you know, Native American artifacts and stuff. So what came out of it was this kind of combination, Hanna-Barbera folk art, settler kind of quilt art, and like Nez Perce parflesh bags kind of mingled together in a way. And so, but basically it was fooling around with paint formalities, you know, painting, searching in paint.
Well, some of them you have like this, like one I'm just looking at is the Columbus Delano,
yep.
I think it's called. And it just seems like, yeah, it's that mix of that Hanna-Barbera, but it seems like there's a lot of fear in the figure too.
Yeah, I mean, the emotion is going to be in there even though they're pretty severe. I mean, it's the kind of what could be conveyed by a weather vane, you know, which is kind of what they're like too.
Mm-hmm.
But they're kind of abstract, except they're these heads. There was one place where it coincided nicely, which was I had this central kind of, you know, the head that shows up over and over, which looks like it's derived from George Jetson or something like that. And it's a man. He's looking two directions, and there's a naked woman on either side of him. So it's like he's trying to, it's that, like, trying to decide, or, you know, the fantasy or whatever. And but then I came across this story in the reading about Samuel Walking Coyote, who was an Indian who went away from his tribe, married a girl from another tribe, even though he already had a wife, and then seeking to return to his former tribe, he caught some bison on the way to bring as a present. And so when he got back to his old tribe with his new wife, they beat him up and kicked him out. But he took the two bison away with him, with his second wife. And then those bison were some of the ones that were bought that started a whole herd of what, you know, are bison now in America, just like the two or three he had. And then, so it had to do with two women. And then, of course, he took the money and got drunk and died under a train trestle of pneumonia. You know.
The tragedy.
Yep. Samuel Walking Coyote.
And the Teddy Roosevelt one with the...
with the big stick.
With the very ample appendage.
Yeah.
Is that just a commentary on
well, the he was person? A hero in the story, you know. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt started undoing a lot of the damage done by Sherman and Ulysses Grant and his advisors, Columbus Delano and so on. And they actually signed legislation to make game reserves in the country. And so that's how the bison was saved, actually, from reporter that, you know, reported on the story, various cowboys that likes bought these bison and started their own herds, and now there's a lot of bison again.
Rescuing the animals. Do you know that L. Feldstein, the old Mad editor?
Uh-huh.
He retired, you know, after getting his pay, a big paycheck from Mad, mm-hmm. and moved into, I think it's Wyoming? Montana. I think he's in Montana, and
yeah.
he has a a ranch that's all rescued animals and stuff.
That's fantastic. Montana has a lot of bison, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. Up there somewhere.
It's pretty interesting, you know, when the old guard from the industry and what he's gone on to do.
Yeah, they do all kinds of things. They move to Long Island and barbecue on their back porches.
I think that's what most of them do. Now,
how often do you have sex?
Once a year.
Do you think that's normal? How often do you have sex?
Once a year.
Do you think that's normal? How often do you have sex?
Once a year.
Your interest in history, what sparked, like, looking into those roots?
Well,
because, I mean, it's definitely, like, part of the whole, I guess, theme, or a big theme.
Of my work in general, kind of.
Yeah.
I guess the other blood is not so exciting or interesting, or it's more muddled, but mm-hmm. when I was a kid, we were around Native American old people that spoke Choctaw. And my grandma, who was, I don't know, she's not half, quite half, she was very different, you know? It was like she was sitting there in a different culture, and she finally had mental problems from it and stuff. Or I don't know what it was from, but maybe. I don't know. Like, I think I said in one of those somewhere, it seemed like when I was a kid, everything was really boring and nothing was happening. But when I started looking back at it, there was all kinds of weird stuff involving, you know, storm shelters, chewing tobacco, and, you know, goofy stuff.
I guess it's like an odd Cold War byproduct.
Yeah, I guess so. The storm shelters, but the bomb shelters, but storm shelters, they really, I mean, my Uncle Clarence, who was a pretty Indian, whatever you want to call him, a Choctaw, he got some money from the government and he bought this like really kind of advanced bomb shelter and put it out on his ranch, you know. And so when the tornado came, he would like go to his advanced bomb shelter and look out the periscope. But there were others where he would just go in some cellar and there would be like box springs and spit cans and too many people in there.
Growing up, I live in Vancouver in BC, and actually, like, First Nations culture is very prominent. Mm-hmm. Where, like, it's a definite, like, part we acknowledge and a part we try to understand of where we are. But I don't have a lot of understanding of like whereabouts your family would be from. So it's interesting learning some of this stuff.
Yeah, mine was from the Native American or by any term. Probably was from Mississippi and then got moved on the Trail of Tears to Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked my grandmother about it once and she really kind of like let me know she wasn't going to say anything about the Indian schools or anything.
Oh, they've been up here. It's quite tragic. A lot of people have gone through with the residential schools and things like that.
Yeah, it's an ongoing nightmare in a way. Due down here probably to the Department of Interior, you know, and everybody else who decided to move here, including me. What can you do?
Is that a factor for yourself, that personal juxtaposition?
Mm-hmm. I think I have kind of an alien point of view, you know. I always felt like kind of an outsider and looking from the outside at everything. But, you know, not that I don't have friends and I'm not connected and stuff, but I think that's the kind of point of view I think it's healthy for me to cultivate as an artist, you know, to have a real, an alien point of view.
I guess it's that stranger in a strange land.
Yeah. And for me, I guess maybe being from a boring place, it was fun to concentrate on all the strangeness, you know. Like, okay, it's boring here. It's a million degrees. I'm standing in a place that's beige on beige on beige, but there's a big beetle rolling a ball of shit down the road, you know. What is that, you know? And there's an armadillo in the underbrush. And there's a big abandoned tractor over there.
I guess that growing up in that must have been really influential as far as the world that you kind of, that Jimbo's in.
Yeah.
Because it has that sparse feel.
Yeah, that's definitely what, it was really just kind of animating that landscape around me, which had a lot of emptiness and a lot of abandoned tractors and piled up pipes and berms and stuff. But it's, you know, most of human activity has that look now, you know. You drive across the country and there's berms and piles of poles and stuff.
I remember seeing my first tumbleweed on a trip through the States.
Wow, they're pretty nasty.
They're big.
Sharp. Yeah, they're big and sharp and heavy. They can crash into your car.
Luckily, we were in a big old pickup truck that was falling apart as we traversed the continent.
Wow.
Now, with Jimbo, I guess he was your first attempt at doing a comic, or your first, like, foray into it?
Yeah,
as an adult?
As an adult, as a quasi-adult, as a young adult. I guess so. I started drawing stream of consciousness comics and kind of doing experiments for a couple of years, and then in 1974 I drew Jimbo's head one day with a pompadour, and he just looked familiar to me, and I just kind of kept it up. I don't know if he was like, it seemed like something, I don't know, it seemed like something when I drew him at the first, you know, so I just kept doing it. And now it's weird, it's like, gee, why am I still doing this? Or is it still something I should do?
Well, it seems like it's not the same thing, a lot of, because I, over the last week I sat down and read all the Jimbo stuff I could get my hands on, and it's definitely, each book feels like it's a different kind of part to the story, and it's the same character, but it's a different world in some ways.
I think that's true, and one thing I hope to do, though I don't know exactly how, is to suggest that there's a whole bigger world there. In some ways, I haven't done very many Jimbo stories. If I'd drawn it as a weekly strip or a monthly, you know, somewhere with a page or something, then I would have had to exhaust a lot more stories, but in a way you just kind of infer that here's this guy from, he got from there to there. Also, my friend Matt Groening started The Simpsons, and it's just a story-eating machine.
Yeah, take some liberties with things you've said.
No, I just mean that, like, it's hard to think up stories they haven't done on The Simpsons. So I think it's good to just do a few stories.
If you ever watched South Park, they had a whole episode about that.
Oh, wow.
Where they, didn't they do that on The Simpsons? And
I didn't know that.
By the end, the characters all look like they're on The Simpsons in that style.
Wow.
Now, Adventures in Paradise, I guess that's the first story arc of Jimbo work?
In my mind, it's always like all one thing, you know. But yeah, it was really helped by Spiegelman, who decided it really needed a story arc in a way. So he helped me fill in kind of, or suggested where I fill in some things, and then I filled them in ways that made more problems.
From what I've heard, he's a pretty hands-on editor, so I was curious about that.
Yeah, he was, and we had a big falling out over that Pantheon book for a while, but it was just youthful and silly, and we all got over it. I really like Art. He's a valuable friend.
I'm actually, next week I'll be talking to Francois. She'll be on the show.
Well, they completely take what they do seriously, you know, and they're not light about it. They care about it, and they work really hard, and they're willing to suffer for their art, you know. And so every time they did Raw, it was just, I mean, as you'll find out from talking to her, maybe she won't say this, but they designed Raw magazine like 40 different ways for every issue that came out.
Really?
It was just like unbelievable. Art and her would pull out these little prototype issues of like, well, here's with Buyer first. If Byrne starts first, then your story, and then Buyer, and then, you know, blah, blah, blah. You'd have these little model books.
And that was while you lived in L.A. that you first got involved with them, right?
Yeah, I lived in L.A. from about 76 to about 85 or 86.
Now, one question I have about your time in L.A. is I've heard that you knew Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, I went to interview Philip K. Dick for Slash magazine because I was a fan of his writing from college and knew other fans of Philip K. Dick. And so I wrote him a fan letter, and then I got a message from Philip K. Dick on my answering machine. And the reason he called me was because his friend K.W. Jeter read Slash magazine and liked my comics and told him he should call me. And so, you know, I got to visit, you know, me and friends and so on, went over to Philip Dick's house maybe, I don't know, 8 or 10 times. I'm not really sure.
What kind of effect did he have on your own work?
Well, I really love the near future. That's really interesting to me, you know. Getting on spaceships and going across, you know, spending like 500 generations to get to some other star system, you know, that's one thing. But it's more exciting, a story about fighting with your door over whether you've paid the rent or not. You know, that's more intriguing to me. And also J.G. Ballard, this is another compelling sci-fi vision or whatever. But Phil Dick was really nice. What was really great, I mean, he was very tolerant. And he always had a different lie he was telling when I went over there, you know. One time I went, and he was like, Gary, I'm leaving for the Middle East next week. I've discovered the secret of life, of eternal life, and it's a certain palm heart. And I'm going to go to the Middle East and harvest the palm heart, and then I'll remember my former lives and my next incarnation.
He sounds like a really tragic person.
He was really funny and fun. I mean, there's a tragedy in that a lot of bad things happened to him and relations were, but I think he kind of enjoyed the turmoil in a way. I mean, if you move to Berkeley or wherever you lived and just invite 100, you know, lots of street kids and Black Panthers to come into your house and wander in and out, you know, day in and day out, and then wonder why the FBI has a file on you, you know, it's like, he's got to be enjoying it. And an exegesis, I don't know. I just think he's a very lively, creative person.
Oh, and he's able to be so prolific too.
Yeah,
in the midst of all of that.
Yeah, and a lot of those, like I like the ones, some of them that read the fastest. Like to me, The Zap Gun is one of my favorite books by Philip K. Dick.
I haven't read it.
And really sad. It's just about this precog fashion weapons system designer, you know, and his wife that's not as smart as him. But anyway,
one of the neat things I find about this stuff, not that I'm here to talk about Philip K. Dick for the next while, but is the fact that, I mean, while it's, you know, quote unquote sci-fi, it's something that it doesn't seem so sci-fi. Like it seems like this could happen in the next while.
He felt totally marginalized and really wanted to be, you know, wanted acclaim in the larger literary world, and was really happy when he got reviewed in major, you know, like the, in literary publications, because he was definitely alive in the time when science fiction wasn't, you know, it just didn't cross over much. I guess it was 1984 crossed over in Brave New World, but
now, does that kind of spill over in your own writing and work?
Well, Jimbo's taking place on Mars sometime in the future, and it's in a Texas and Japanese colony on Mars that's been there for maybe 100 years, and so, but it's real, I don't know. And it's going back in time instead of forward in time, so all these artifacts are appearing in the ground, being dug up, you know. But it's not one consistent lie, you know. It's a bunch of different lies, but it's the lying form, the fiction form.
Now, in the first Jimbo book, I read all the stuff without reading what you had commented and stuff, and I tried just to go in it, just raw, you know. Excuse the pun. And I found that in the Adventures in Paradise, the end of it incredibly tragic. The part with the horse.
Yeah, no, it's really. I've been like hysterical a lot of times. I'm a real crybaby, you know. And during that story, it was very emotionally upsetting. But it was really contemplating again, like the Native American reading. It's also when you just contemplate World War II, you know, what everyone did to everyone on all sides, and then how it ended up. It's just pretty awful, you know. And so apologies were kind of due all around. And no apology can suffice, you know. So I did a stupid comic strip, you know. It really did encompass, like, really simple things, like, you know, learning to not kill animals when you're a kid, you know, like that could give you a bad feeling. The thing about the horse and the bird and all of that, I mean, that bird thing, you know, when I got my first BB gun, I went out and accidentally shot a bird. And I still feel bad about it, you know. And one time when I was about 8, some kid put a big shotgun in my hands and I shot a bunch of frogs in a pond, you know, so I don't know. But I eat hamburgers. So it's all a delusion.
It's all how it happens, right?
Yeah.
So.
Well, intent maybe has something to do with things.
Maybe it's that loss of innocence, too.
Yeah. Having to do bad to learn the difference.
Now, in that story, or in that set of pages, you utilize a different style.
Almost on every page or every spread, and sometimes in panel to panel.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Spiegelman really liked about my work. In some ways, my work's probably too consistent for maybe what Spiegelman's vision of what my work could be, in a way. But anyway, he always really, I mean, that those guys took me serious was fantastic, I gotta say. But yeah, it changes stylistically, and it refers to things like Dürer. It refers to, I can't remember who it was in Michelangelo's time who did very foreshortened horse battle scenes. I can't remember his name right now. And a bunch of stuff. And I had to learn to draw horse. I'm sorry. My father's a horse painter, you know. I don't particularly show him the strip, but I kind of felt like I had to learn how to draw horses to do the strip. And the horse is not consistent species-wise or anything from page to page.
Well, the horse was used as the first silent movie, wasn't it? Or one of the first ones that was used to understand the galloping?
Oh, Muy Bridges. Yeah, there's really good books on his animals in motion and humans in motion. Yeah.
Now, when you use the different styles, what's the idea behind that? Is it just some kind of, like you're talking about stream of consciousness drawing, is that a part of it, or is it, okay, this part of the story will be more visceral?
Well, it's kind of like a freedom I allow myself, but I could draw a whole bunch of different ways, but they do have they telegraph different things emotionally. So I guess I try to let the style serve the emotion, or I try to let the style serve the formal exploration. And, you know, it's not always great communicate, you know, it's not always the greatest way to communicate with people is to experiment on them. But that's what I'm into, and I think there's room for that. You know, I think I read the Comics Journal chat in various places, you know, and guys are like, God, he just can't draw. He just doesn't try. He's just fucking with our heads, you know? And
you can swear, don't worry. We're in Canada.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's good. You can bleep it or something.
No. I'm college radio. It's Canada. You can do
okay,
what you want.
Cool. Very good. But anyway, I'm not trying to fool anyone. I'm just trying to enjoy my life, you know. I'm just trying to figure out what it is I could do here for a few more minutes, you know.
Is that something that sometimes can be a problem? Is that formalism that people... I'm trying to have the right statement for this, because there's this big, you know, the argument of craft versus...
Oh. Well, to me, there's like not a single ambition for craft. There's not a single goal for craft. And you could like be able to have masterful chop, all kinds of chops, but you don't necessarily make great art by having great chops.
Mm-hmm.
You could be the greatest technician or the greatest craftsman, but it's really going to take vision, and it's going to take some kind of common humanity or some kind of awareness of history or some kind of evolutionary spark or something for it to be more than just, you know, the finest. It's not to be, there's something to be said. I mean, it is, again, on the other hand, I can understand, like, if someone's magazine illustration is their art and that's the art they want to do, and if someone just wants to be the best wood carver in the world and that's their artistic ambition, that's great. But it doesn't make it the greatest art in the world. And I think that idea, the greatest art in the world, is really relative to who's doing the looking. I don't expect everyone to like my work. I'm glad some people do. But the people that maybe get mad about it are the people that maybe think I'm trying to win them over too, and I'm really only trying to win the people over who might just look at it and go, oh, I wish I did that, or something. You know?
It reminds me of a little Ralph Steadman thing. I read his memoirs of his time with Hunter and his first time meeting Hunter. He's drawing, and he lost his art supplies on his way to the Kentucky Derby, and he had makeup he was using. He's sitting at this table drawing with his makeup, and Hunter got physically repulsed and angry by this like ugly artwork, and it, you know, at that point, you know, told him to stop because he was going to scare people, and decided to mace him. But it's that, you know, it's that things work different way for different people, I guess.
Yeah, they absolutely do.
Because that ugliness captured what he was going for in the story that he wasn't able to do in words.
Oh, yeah. I mean, their styles really complemented each other. They were both stronger by their association. And but you can see, you know, Steadman coming out of Francis Bacon and all kinds of other powerful art, you know, so it's kind of a stream.
Yeah.
And that was part one of my interview with Gary Panter. And you can find part two at www.inkstuds.com. And thanks for listening, everyone.
Forward to time and time and time again, and time and smut shows won't be worth my face looks older than yes I die. It's today, it's tomorrow, I'm only backwards, only
no one cares about my man.